This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Wholeness, Winning in Life from the Inside Out by Tore Roberts. Published by Zondervan and read by the author. Foreword written and read by T.D. Jakes. I dedicate this book to all of God's creation from every tribe, language, nation, and culture. Humanity, this one's for you.
One doesn't have to live a long time before realizing that neither the multi-billion-dollar cosmetology industry with its makeup magic, nor the distinguished dermatology profession with its ability to correct flaws we all wish we didn't have, can cover the scars that lie deep within. Yet we expend countless dollars to add to our bag of tricks, various shades, textures, and fabrics of the fashion industry with its memorable brand name apparels, expensive accessories, and accoutrements of glitz and glitter, none of which can remove the bruises of experience. Not one of us is exempt from the private fears deep inside the human soul that certain memories and mismanagements have left us with. All of these artificial solutions only camouflage the shattered people beneath our elaborate masks. We need only take a tour of the homes of the rich and famous, or stride into the urban areas, Red Belt states, and Appalachian mountains to know that while the tools are different, the issues remain the same. Hidden beneath cowboy hats and Levi's, or the sagging jeans and overpriced sneakers of low-income kids, all cultures and classes pay exorbitant prices to cover what they cannot correct. 24-hour fitness centers hiss and turn into the wee hours of the morning to help us maintain the physiques we all like to see. But when all is stripped away, we live not with our image, but with our realities, which neither treadmill nor eyeliner can erase. Although the outer appearance may look fantastic, anyone who has ever dated can tell you that what you see isn't always what you get. Once you date the so-called beautiful people, you find out that not all that glitters is gold. This is not to say that the less aesthetic ones amongst us are any more whole or heal, because pain is without prejudice. It reaches us all. This is why I'm happy that you are about to embark on a journey of wholeness. Author Tore Roberts has penned a powerful reminder to each and every one of us that no amount of money spent on that which surrounds us will deliver us from the wounds within us. This powerful, thought-provoking messenger is the drum major who dares to march to a different beat and leads us to the place where we can finally hear the sound that transforms us from the mundane to the miraculous. Those of us who march through life with half smiles and fully broken hearts to the dissonant sound of real regrets and mayhem are Tore's focus. It is a less than merry band of life's participants he feels committed to lead into a place of harmony that they never thought they could successfully attain. I first met Tore Roberts when he was courting my youngest daughter. I opened the door of my home with the skepticism that most fathers have when their daughter's talking too much about someone they don't know. I pulled up a chair and dropped my glasses to the bridge of my nose to observe this young man who I thought on first blush was just another bag of britches and brawn. As I watched and listened, prayed and pondered, I became more and more impressed with his insights and honesty, intrigue and curiosity, from which the message of this book was formulated. I eventually became so captivated and convinced, as I'm sure you will, that he is the perfect one to discuss wholeness with us. Eventually, Tore went from suitor to groom, and I traded my skeptical glare for a gaze of deep admiration. We have grown in our relationship, and I have evolved from doubter to dad as I became a spiritual mentor and a father in the faith to this uniquely gifted individual. Although I originally met him as a guy who seemed too good to be true, he quickly turned into an associate about whom I would wonder how we ever did anything of consequence without him. His story is captivating and his words transformative in a way that his peaceful presence and quiet tone belie. One would never guess the tempestuous ride Toray has taken to prepare him for the task of drum major of a band of less than merry men and women. In his message, you can hear the honest application of truth, coupled with the fact that he emerges from his dangerous beginnings, having tried what he teaches and having partaken of what he now preaches to any who will listen and read his map to recovery. What is inspiring is his infectious love of people and his dedicated commitment to leading all those around him to that place of wholeness and tranquility to which he himself has arrived. As I read through the early renderings of this riveting book, I could clearly see that Toray has discovered and delivered to all who will follow a path to wholeness that gets in the groove between theology and psychology with a lesson in the art of life, a lesson that neither theology or psychology left to itself completely conveys. But with both studies, like drumsticks in the hand of a drummer, he beats out a rhythm that revives the weary and rejuvenates the disenfranchised. By the time I finished this book, I felt as though I had been in the Underground Railroad with Harriet Tubman, leading slaves to freedom, or in South Africa, watching Nelson Mandela and singing with the liberated in the aftermath of apartheid. Maybe it was written with the gentleness of Mother Teresa in Calcutta, feeding the trembling lips of a starving child. No, in fact, it was Toray Roberts, the man, the message, and the missive that left me thinking how vitally important this timely book would be in the hands of those who are secretly captive to the memories and agonies all of us are in some way exposed to. Welcome to the Freedom Train to Wholeness. This book is not an expenditure of time or treasure. It is rather an investment in the innumerable possibilities all of us can attain if we decide to spend less on what surrounds us and more on what's within us. The returns on wholeness far exceed the investment. This is healing in a bag for those of us who refuse to look like or live like where we came from. I present to you my son in faith and family, and the work and wealth of Toray Roberts' Wholeness.
Preface, Becoming Whole. From as far back as I can remember, I've had an unsettled spirit. I've been constantly on the move, looking for how things in my life could be bigger and better, and how I could be wiser. I've always been searching for more, a trait I undoubtedly inherited from my mother. My remarkable mother never let being a single parent with limited resources keep her from pursuing more in life. She refused to settle. She was determined to seek out the best that life had to offer us, and that's what she did. While I was growing up, I watched her rise from receptionist to executive and move from renting homes to buying them. In hindsight, I know that the changes happening in Mom's external life were directly related to what she was experiencing internally. It was her non-visible transformation, the pursuit of a vibrant and healthy inner life, that fueled her external success. Mom had discovered the power of pursuing wholeness. There isn't a subject that I am more passionate about, one that I want every person to understand before leaving Earth, than the reality of wholeness. Throughout this book, we'll explore the deeper meaning of wholeness, but in the simplest terms, wholeness is the state of being complete. It means to be unbroken, having no cracks or missing parts that unhealthy and unprofitable fillers can occupy. Wholeness is the highest and healthiest version of any person, a version so awesome that to die before experiencing it would be one of life's greatest tragedies. The process of becoming whole is like a perpetual heart, mind, and soul makeover, with a better you emerging with every cycle of growth. Cracks in your soul begin to mend, and wrinkles in your spirit are smoothed out, revealing the masterpiece you were created to be. It doesn't matter if you're a single parent, successful business person, or celebrity. At the core, our issues are the same, and the solution is the same: becoming whole. Wholeness is the greatest state of being this life offers, and we can all begin to pursue it right where we are. In my role as pastor of a large church, I've witnessed this transformation up close and personal. But before watching people experience wholeness, I was witness to something else. In the early days of our church especially, I was puzzled by a recurring pattern I noticed in members of the congregation. At the time, we were drawing many up-and-coming actors, models, singers, and musicians. I was stunned by their talents, giftedness, and beauty. Yet at the same time, I couldn't understand why so many were insecure, fearful, depressed, and unsuccessful. They did not lack talent or skill, yet they struggled to succeed and move forward in their lives. After closely observing this, I realized something. Their instability was tied to hidden areas of brokenness in their lives. This brokenness was sabotaging not only their careers, but also their relationships. As I got to know these people better, I recognized that their self-perception and perception of life in general was skewed and unhealthy. The irony was that most of these young artists had been full of hope and inspiration when they left home to pursue their careers. However, after getting to Los Angeles, they became discouraged, some nearly to the point of giving up. It would be easy to surmise that the pressures and hard knocks of life in Hollywood brought on this brokenness, that the callous culture of show business was to blame. But pastoring these talented aspirants led me to a different conclusion. What became evident was that they were broken before they got here. It simply took the sometimes cold-hearted environment of Hollywood to draw their brokenness to the surface. I met beautiful supermodels who saw themselves as nothing but ugly and overweight. I witnessed brilliant people who were afraid to speak up because their brokenness told them they weren't smart enough to give input. I saw people trapped in abusive relationships because something told them they deserved the abuse and that life would not afford them anything better. Over the years, I came across countless stories like these, and there was one common denominator: some form of brokenness. Each person had broken areas within, creating broken paradigms and ultimately producing broken and unfulfilled lives. Now, this is where you may begin to wonder if this book is for you. After reading some of these stories, you may think that you are in pretty good shape. However, even if you feel more whole than the people I described, make no mistake, none of us escape life's breakings. Whether you were teased as a child, were overlooked in your family, endured a divorce, or experienced any combination of the unlimited ways a person can be broken, life spares its rod on no one. Brokenness costs all of us something, and until we are made whole on every level, we live leaking, some of us more than others. If brokenness never gets resolved over a lifetime, one person's small leak that goes untended for decades can cost that person significantly more than does the huge leak of a person who decides early on to pursue wholeness. This book is about helping you address the leaks no matter where you are on your path. Bigger, better, wiser, and happier is waiting for you in the land of wholeness. Let's journey with each other, page by page, and together we'll be made whole. Part 1. Things we tell ourselves that keep us from wholeness. Chapter 1. I thought I was whole already. This is a waste of time, I sighed to myself, and reluctantly endured the relentless Los Angeles traffic to make a doctor's appointment, an appointment I felt was unnecessary. My persistent mother had been asking me for months to get a physical. She firmly believed I needed to be proactive about my health, regardless of how healthy I may have felt I was. For me, however, getting a checkup was the last thing on my mind. I felt great, and things in my life couldn't be better. I was an energetic socialite with a large network of friends. I was a top performer in the technology industry and had a robust pipeline filled with lucrative deals to be closed. I was making great money and had a solid 5-year plan. I had a good rhythm going. The last place I wanted to be was at the doctor's office. Nevertheless, as a courtesy to my mom, I found myself pulling into the parking spot there and heading into the building. The woman behind the counter checked me in and handed me a pen and a clipboard full of forms. The paperwork included a questionnaire with a long list of diseases and health conditions. As I checked off the no box next to each one, I remember gloating over how healthy I was, reinforcing to myself how unnecessary the doctor's visit was. Soon, a nurse escorted me to an examination room and took my vitals, pulse, temperature, respiration, and blood pressure. She smiled and said in an assuring tone that everything looked really good. She made a few notes in my file and told me that the doctor would be in to see me shortly. A few minutes later, the doctor walked in, greeted me, flipped through my file, and confirmed the nurse's account of my healthy vital signs. I felt relieved and thought my visit would soon come to an end. Everything had proven to be just fine, which meant I could get Mom off my back and officially add good health to the checklist of things going right in my life. Another slam dunk. But it turned out that the examination had merely scratched the surface. I learned that the most trustworthy diagnoses in life don't come from surface-level examinations. To get to the truth of the matter requires digging more deeply. In this case, digging more deeply required a blood draw. We had heard the testimony of my externals, but now it was time for my insides to take the stand. After a few days, my blood results came in, and I was shocked by what they revealed. I was suffering from a condition that, if left untreated, would put me at risk for heart disease. It was a condition that could threaten my life. When it came to my health, things definitely were not as good as they appeared. I felt numb and confused. How could everything seem fine when in reality a train wreck was swiftly approaching? This tough news became the catalyst for change that affected not only how I approached my physical health, but also how I approached my life. It's easy to become so distracted in our efforts to create a life that we fail to consider whether we may have ailments that threaten the very life we are striving to create. For example, we might want to marry the one, but fail to realize that until we become one within ourselves, happily ever after isn't likely going to happen. Or we might desire to be financially secure and don't have trouble earning money, but somehow still end up living from paycheck to paycheck. Money slips right through our hands because something beneath the surface causes us to squander what we earn. Could it be that sometimes you never achieve what you're striving for because a hidden issue is sabotaging you? Are you assuming you're living the best life possible when the truth is that undetected issues are working against the very best that life has to offer you? I realize that these may be jarring questions, but just as I had to experience a rude awakening to change the trajectory of my life, perhaps you're due for a wake-up call as well. After years of counseling hundreds of perfectly normal people through frustrating circumstances that ultimately expose deep under-the-surface issues, I believe we owe it to ourselves to make sure we don't go through life without taking inventory of who we are inside. The great news is that having encouraged countless people to commit to specific disciplines, I've witnessed astounding results. I've seen people with fairly good and manageable lives experience a new dimension of existence they once didn't even believe was possible. I've witnessed others whose lives were in shambles experience life makeovers and find beauty and great treasure where they once saw only ruins. These people have experienced such dramatic transformations that who they once were now seems nearly unrecognizable to them. I've got my own story of transformation to tell, but we'll get to that soon enough. For now, I want to return to what I learned from my doctor's visit, three life-changing principles that helped me chart a new course. 1. Never overestimate yourself. We are often encouraged not to underestimate ourselves, and I believe in that wholeheartedly. Not underestimating yourself is about believing in yourself and your potential for greatness. There is more potential within us than we could ever fathom, and so we should never think little of ourselves or shrink back from pushing the boundaries of what we can achieve. At the same time, we can't be so sure of ourselves that we deceive ourselves. Failing to take an inner inventory could prove to be a great mistake with severe consequences. Jesus made a provocative statement concerning self-examination. They that are whole have no need of a physician. Mark chapter 2, verse 17, American Standard Version. It appears that Jesus is saying that a physician, someone who makes others whole, is relevant only to those who are sick. If you believe you are already whole, you have no need for the wholeness the doctor can bring. Is Jesus saying that only some people need to be made whole, or is he implying something different? Could it be that Jesus is really saying that people who mistakenly think they are whole close themselves off to the healing they don't realize they need? It is difficult for most of us to see ourselves as we are. We all have blind spots that keep us from seeing what's going on beneath the surface. If we haven't learned how to be self-aware, our inner layers remain hidden from us. And living our best possible lives will elude us if we overestimate ourselves by assuming we are already living them. Jesus doesn't let anyone off the hook when it comes to being whole. He understands our need to discover and pursue wholeness at every stage of life, regardless of how well we may appear in our own eyes. Overestimating ourselves keeps us not only from becoming truly whole, but also from experiencing the rich existence that comes only through wholeness. Number 2, prioritize your inner over your outer. When I was a teenager, an elderly woman named Clara Jones attended our church. Clara always made it a point to dialogue with the young people and encourage us with kind words. I remember this one exchange that she had with me nearly every time she saw me. It went something like this. "Hi, Teray. You sure are a good-looking young man." Before I can get in a good blush, she followed up with, "Make sure you're just as handsome on the inside as you are on the outside." Her follow-up comment about my insides wasn't exactly deflating, but it certainly balanced the pride I felt when she paid the initial compliment. "Yes, ma'am," I always modestly replied and continued on my way until our paths crossed again. Mrs. Jones and I had that same exchange dozens of times, year after year. It got to the point that I was tempted to finish her thought for her. I always wondered if she had forgotten we'd had that exact dialogue the last time we'd seen each other. Her words, although gracious and affirming, also challenged a deep part of me. It took years and a plethora of life lessons before I realized the powerful truth of her simple phrase. Prioritize your inner life over your outer life, your inner success over your outer success, and your inner beauty over your outer beauty. It's a truth our world desperately needs to hear. We live in a world obsessed with outer improvement. Cosmetic surgery in America has become a $13 billion industry. There are more new fitness programs popping up than we can keep up with, each promising six-pack abs, toned arms, and lean thighs. Even high fashion has trickled down from the runways of Paris into the hallways of elementary schools as our youngsters are striving to be somebody, or at least to look like it. Our culture is fascinated with image and appearance like never before. Studies show that more than one out of three Americans are in debt, oftentimes living above their means to maintain some glamorous facade. Technology and social media feed this obsession with externals. Why have a double chin when an app can remove it from that selfie you just took? And go ahead, slim down your waistline, bulk up your biceps, and lighten or darken your skin tone. If you alter your image to perfection, you'll no doubt be rewarded with the likes from other users, which not only reinforces your need for their approval, but makes it even harder to be who you really are. The irony is that oftentimes the people on the other end of those coveted affirmations are also approval seekers hiding behind altered images of their own. They too are seeking the almighty like for themselves. And so we find ourselves living in a culture that seeks instant affirmation based not on who we are inwardly, but on who we can present ourselves to be outwardly. Mrs. Jones would not approve. To avoid any misunderstanding, let me make one thing plain. I believe in taking pride in your appearance. I like to think I've got a slight knack for fashion myself. I also believe that being diligent in self-care is important. I live by this rule, and I teach it to my children and others. Without a doubt, how you present yourself in life is important. But today's desperate pursuit of approval based on outward appearances is causing a famine beneath the surface, and we neglect who we are inwardly to our peril. There are two aspects to every human being, the ideal and the real. The ideal you is who you desire to be, who you strive to be, and sometimes who you pretend to be. It's the version you want others to see. It's the part of you that strives for all the likes. That's the ideal you. The real you is much different. It's the you that lives beneath the surface. It's the most honest version of yourself. The real you is rarely known to others, and truth be told, is often little known even to yourself. It's the place where your flaws live, both known flaws and the ones that hide in your blind spots. It's the version of you that has been shaped by many factors, both positive and negative. This is the part of you that determines how you see and respond to circumstances. Much of what you experience in your outer life is the direct result of what is happening in the complex recesses of your inner life, the real you. Hidden behind Mrs. Jones' simple encouragement, make sure you're just as beautiful on the inside as you are on the outside, is a priceless and powerful insight. She was no doubt familiar with this pearl of wisdom from the book of Proverbs. Above every charge keep thy heart, for out of it are the outgoings of life. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 23, Young's literal translation. The Hebrew word translated heart in this passage isn't referring to the physical heart in the center of your chest. It's speaking of the totality of your insides, your feelings, your will, and your intellect, all of which exist in the core of who you are. The point the proverb wants to make is that your outer life emanates from your inner life, and that means your inner life must be diligently understood, protected, and nurtured. This is the basis of wholeness. To experience wholeness, you must acknowledge your inner life, ensure its well-being, and pursue and preserve the healthiest version of the real you. 3. Be proactive, not passive, when pursuing wholeness. My rude awakening after my doctor's visit stripped me of the luxury of being passive about my physical health. The message was loud and clear. Physical health is nothing to take for granted. I know this isn't rocket science or even a profound epiphany for most of us. Even if we don't attend to it as well as we should, we already know that things like regular exercise and good nutrition are essential for health. However, many of us do need an epiphany when it comes to emotional and spiritual health. We still don't seem to understand that we need to be just as proactive about the health of our inner person as we are about the health of our body. There are all sorts of reasons why most people might not prioritize the health of their inner person. For the most part, people can be divided into three groups: those who don't know, those who don't know what to do, and those who are afraid to act on what they know. Number one, those who don't know. These are well-meaning people who do the best they can in life, but haven't been awakened to the truth that best begins from within. They take life as is and tend to adapt to their environment and circumstances rather than try to change them. They can't pursue wholeness because they have little to no understanding of what wholeness is. Their ignorance is their vice. Number two, those who don't know what to do. These people are often frustrated in life, yet feel helpless to do anything about it. They want peace, happiness, and fulfillment, but always seem to run into obstacles they can't overcome. They desire wholeness, but don't know how to get there. Number three, those who are afraid to act on what they know. These people understand their need for wholeness and the effort needed to get there. However, they fail to pursue wholeness because they are held hostage by fear and are intimidated by the work required to achieve it. They want a better life, but are afraid to get to the bottom of whatever prevents them from taking action. Wholeness is within their reach, but they are afraid to pay the cost. You are reading this book for a reason. Perhaps you have never considered that you aren't already whole. It's possible that wholeness is a brand new concept. If that's you, I get it. I was once there too. My prayer for you is that your eyes will be open to the rich and rewarding life that becoming whole will afford you if you pursue it. Wholeness is the highest and healthiest version of a person. It is like the character of wisdom in Proverbs, who protects and watches over its subjects. Wholeness often calls me to change, to believe in the impossible, and to go beyond myself to become a greater me. As we journey through these pages together, I invite you to picture wholeness as a person who changed my life and who can change yours too. Wholeness is going to require you to dig deep. You must be willing to visit places within yourself you may never have been to and to enter rooms in your heart you've been afraid to go into, but don't worry. Wholeness is going to guide you, comfort you, encourage you, and cheer you on. Wholeness is excited that you've taken this first step. You've already begun to win. Now, let's go farther. Chapter 2. It's not a big deal. I never thought I'd be a pastor. I had no idea it was in the divine plan for me. I don't hail from a long line of ministers, nor did I ever have any early aspirations for ministry. If you had told me in my early 20s that I would one day be a spiritual leader, I would have laughed and asked you what you'd been smoking and inquired as to where I might get the same. The truth is, I didn't choose this path. This path chose me, and I'm constantly floored with gratitude that it did. One of the things I love most about being a pastor is having a front row seat to what God is doing in people's lives. There's nothing more remarkable than witnessing the transformation of a human life. Maybe you understand what I'm talking about because you've seen it too. It's the beauty of watching someone experience a complete life renovation and then enjoy the freedom to dream, soar, and accomplish things they never knew they were capable of. What makes this experience even more beautiful for me is when I get to be the vessel God uses to facilitate such a divine work. It's a tremendous honor and a great reward that many of us pastors enjoy. And yet, I have to admit that being a pastor comes with its share of challenges. The one that grieves me the most, human complacency. It's an attitude of the heart that says, I'm content with average. Wholeness, it's not a big deal. There's nothing more challenging in my role as pastor than wanting more for people than they want for themselves. When that happens, my greatest gift, the ability to see the highest potential in a person, feels more like my greatest burden. The gift motivates me to invest in others as passionately as I invest in myself. Yet many times I end up feeling deflated and disappointed by those who choose complacency over progress. They express high aspirations in the empowering atmosphere of church service or a counseling session, but their lack of follow-through communicates what they're really thinking. It's not a big deal. It's not exactly where I want to be, but I'll just accept life right where it is. Mediocrity. What first comes to mind when you hear the word mediocrity? Chances are, whatever feels like mediocrity to you may not feel like mediocrity to someone else. Why? Because mediocrity is subjective. What looks mediocre to one person may look like achievement to another. And if we are pushing the boundaries of our own growth and potential, the achievements we reach in this season of life may feel like mediocrity in the next season. Allow me to illustrate with a personal story. The latest addition to our family is our beautiful daughter, Ella. When she was learning to walk, she began by standing for long periods of time without our help. Each time she stood on her own, we enthusiastically applauded her and cheered, "Yay, Ella!" This really boosted her confidence, causing her to smile radiantly and wait for the next opportunity to be praised. Her sense of what was acceptable was formed by our applause and affirmations. After a few weeks of this, she began to applaud herself. When she stood on her own, she clapped her tiny hands together without any prompting from us. Her standard for excellence had been shaped by our praise, and consequently, she praised herself by that same measure. This meant that in addition to building Ella's confidence, our affirmations also established her parameters for what was good, appropriate, and acceptable. All of this was fine while Ella was learning to walk, but I hope we aren't still applauding her for standing up when she's 4 or 10 or 16. And I hope she won't be satisfied with applauding herself for the same reasons. When she has the potential to walk, run, leap, and dance, why should she ever settle for merely standing up? As parents, our job is to encourage our children throughout life and to help them grow. That includes creating an environment within our home that gives them confidence and allows them to flourish. However, it also means equipping our children to venture outside the home in ways that will challenge and stretch them. If we fail in this regard, the same nurturing environment that first affirmed them will end up putting borders on their potential. Our views about what makes an effort mediocre or commendable are the byproduct of what we've been exposed to, and those standards change depending on how much we've accomplished. Have you ever found yourself feeling like a rock star in one environment, but then feeling like a total incompetent in a new one? What's exemplary in one context becomes basic in the next. This is normal when you're committed to progress. What once was your ceiling becomes your floor. That's why it's important that we never allow ourselves to be complacent about our growth in and toward wholeness. We have to keep challenging and stretching ourselves so we don't fall short of our potential. Halfway up the mountain. We typically associate the word mediocre with terms like ordinary, average, undistinguished, and middle of the road. However, when I did a little digging, I discovered that the linguistic origins of the word actually suggest something slightly different and more profound. The word mediocre originates from the Latin mediocris, which is composed of two other Latin words, medi, which means mid, and ocris, meaning rugged mountain. When we put those two words together, the literal translation is mid-rugged mountain or halfway up the mountain. That image provides a very different perspective on what the word mediocre really means. It suggests that being mediocre is not just being ordinary or average. It means that someone who is mediocre hasn't reached the peak of his or her potential, but has instead stalled out at the halfway point. And it wasn't too long ago that I came to understand how easy it is to stall out halfway up the mountain. By the age of 40, I felt like I had made good strides in reaching some mountaintops in my life. I had founded a church from scratch that in just 12 years had more than 3,000 people attending each week. We also streamed our services online and had tens of thousands of viewers from around the world. I'd signed a contract with a prominent publisher, and my first book would soon be hitting the shelves. Even better, my success with the church led to a meeting with a beautiful woman named Sarah, whom I married just 9 months later. Talk about a mountaintop experience. In addition to love, friendship, and children, Sarah also brought two unexpected gifts into my life. Her parents. From our first meeting, Thomas Dexter and Sarita Ann Jakes loved me like their own son. Mrs. Jakes lavished me with affirmation and meaningful Christmas and housewarming gifts, and she regularly expressed her appreciation for the way I cared for her daughter. Mr. Jakes, more widely known on every continent as Bishop T.D. Jakes, embraced me warmly as well, although he did spend quite a bit of time checking me out first. As he would say, he had to kick the tires and shake the tree a little to make sure there were no hidden surprises. He wanted to ensure that the man who would be caring for his daughter had the capacity to do so. Eventually, he took me in, but only after the CIA cleared my background. Just kidding, I think. Dad Jakes and I have developed an incredible relationship. The wisdom, guidance, and knowledge afforded me through our friendship is priceless. But perhaps the biggest gift he's given me was removing the veil of mediocrity from my eyes. From the beginning of our relationship, he affirmed two things in me: what I had already accomplished and what I had yet to accomplish. He helped me see that I was only halfway up my mountain, not standing near the top. In hindsight, I can see that there was little around me challenging me to go farther. All I could hear in the environment around me was applause. I'd built a successful church that, in terms of attendance, resources, recognition, and influence, had surpassed every church I'd been exposed to as I was growing up. I was the first in my family to publish a book, and had gone much farther in life than my father had before he passed away. Compared to most people I had grown up with in the inner city, I had shattered every threshold for success. From the graffitied walls of Watts, where I grew up, to the hills overlooking the city that I now call home, the only sound I heard was applause. The people around me were applauding, and like my little daughter Ella, I was applauding myself. But Dad Jake's mentorship and motivation revealed to me something I didn't know about applause. It is often deceiving. My accomplishments were indeed worthy of applause, but not the type of applause that says, "Congratulations, you've arrived. Welcome to the mountaintop." Instead, it was the kind of true applause meant to do what Dad Jake's did for me, affirm what I had accomplished, but also remind me of what I had yet to achieve. This kind of applause says, "Great job getting halfway up the mountain. Now keep going." At the time, everyone in my world was cheering about my halfway point, but wholeness was calling me higher up the mountain toward my potential. Wholeness had conspired with Dad, causing him to affirm my accomplishments, but more importantly, to speak to my potential. Wholeness always calls you higher and constantly looks for a way to expose you to greater possibilities. Wholeness wants to stretch your mind by giving you a vision of what is possible, hoping you will have the faith and fortitude to do whatever is required to keep climbing your mountain. Wholeness won't climb your mountain for you, nor will he force you up the mountain. All he will do is extend the invitation, promise the beauty of the mountaintop, inspire the strength needed to ascend, and rejoice over who you become in the process. When wholeness calls you higher, you will have to resist the gravitational pull of complacency, or what I sometimes call sameness. The journey forward is an ascent. It will always be far easier for you to stay the same than it will be for you to do the work needed to climb farther up your mountain. You have to overcome the downward pull of sameness. Even when your desire for wholeness is strong and you feel excited and optimistic about your future, your natural human tendencies are inclined to revert back to what has always been. You've got to fight for your progress and resist the forces within that resist change. I've seen this downward pull of sameness with people who have come to me for counseling. Their circumstances prompted their desire for change, but their lack of resolve kept them from doing anything differently. In the presence of knowledge and wisdom, they saw the light. But when they returned to the environment in which they needed to make a change, they lost their fortitude and their plans dissolved. On the other hand, I have also counseled others who were so committed to the vision of wholeness for their lives that they submitted to the process, fought the pressures of gravity, and experienced the new life that was waiting for them on the other side. In the pursuit of wholeness, we always have a choice: to give in to the pressure of sameness or to draw on God's power to keep climbing. Smallsville or Destiny Land? I've got a question for you. Have you identified your greatest fear? I know what mine is, and I want to share it with you, though it may not be what you expect. It has nothing to do with dying or losing everything I've amassed. It's not even the fear of losing loved ones, although that would be devastating. My greatest fear is this: not reaching my potential in life. Although I've written and preached about disciplines for overcoming many fears in life, this is one fear I give you full permission to have. Your potential is so critical and valuable that the idea of not fully reaching it should alarm you. It alarms me unlike anything else. The agony of wondering what I may have left on the table in life is too much to bear. Did I do everything I possibly could to avoid mediocrity, to avoid stalling out and settling for life halfway up my mountain? Did I play the hand I was dealt well, or did I stall while complaining about my cards? Is contentment with my accomplishments to date deceiving me into thinking I have reached my mountaintop? Or am I continuing to heed the call that beckons me upward? Have I allowed the applause of my environment to drown out the faint voice of wholeness whispering, there's more? As those who are being made whole, we must regularly ask ourselves these questions. They help us take the blinders off and see where we're really at in life. Potential is often described as something that must be reached. But the word reach has two meanings: arriving at the destination and also stretching ourselves to get there. You may ask, if my potential is always out in front of me, always higher on the mountain, how will I even know when I reach it? Here's the truth. For most of your life, you probably won't know. Potential will always be beyond what you thought. That's why you and I must always keep reaching. I sometimes describe this as resisting the temptation to settle in Smallsville and instead making the decision to climb up to Destiny Land. As we've already noted in our discussion of mediocrity, Smallsville and Destiny Land are always changing. What was once Destiny Land for you becomes Smallsville as you climb higher up the mountain of potential. I've got another question for you. Where would you say you're living right now? In Smallsville, where you know your way around, are known by everyone, and have nothing to challenge you? Or in Destiny Land, the scary place where you feel like a stranger, but are comforted by the presence and the promises of the God who travels with you? If you've been living in Smallsville, I encourage you to move out and hit the upward trail. Destiny Land is waiting for you, and it's worth any cost you have to pay to get there. It's important to keep one thing in mind while moving up your mountain, and that is patience. Challenging yourself to grow is not the same thing as beating yourself up. You must be your own best friend and cheerleader, not your own worst critic, on your way up the mountain. When wholeness calls you higher, his tone is not one of disappointment or disapproval. Instead, he speaks with the voice of encouragement and confidence, and he wants you to believe in your ability to rise to the occasion. Wholeness never calls you beyond your ability. He calls you according to it. Are you ready to grow? Do you hear wholeness calling you by name and inviting you to more? Climbing the mountain will take work, and it will take some time. But God has equipped you with everything you need to take your next step. The life waiting for you on the other side of transformation is a very big deal indeed, and more than worth the effort required to reach it. Chapter 3. I'm okay. Up to this point, we've dealt with two out of the three most common things we tell ourselves that keep us from wholeness. I thought I was whole already, and it's not a big deal. However, I'm convinced that nothing we tell ourselves poses more of a threat to our wholeness than the phrase, I'm okay. Too often, these words effortlessly roll off our tongues as a reflexive response to anything that questions our strength or our ability to have it all together. I may be devastated, but I'm okay. I'm experiencing tremendous pain, but I'm okay. Someone I love hurt me deeply, but I'm okay. Maybe you've said words like these to yourself. I know I have. I routinely said them to myself until a difficult circumstance several years ago forced me to finally admit, I'm not okay. It was just a few weeks away from Father's Day, and I wanted to do something special for my dad. My biological father and I didn't have the best relationship. I never truly felt close to him. My early childhood memories of my father are vague to non-existent. If it weren't for a few photos I managed to collect over the years, I wouldn't have known he was even around when I was young. I have more vivid memories of times with my dad from my adolescence, as I can recall him making several trips to our home to pick me up for the weekend. My father was a strict disciplinarian, and I dreaded weekend visits with him, sometimes to the point of tears. He was hard on me, and I was afraid of him. It was in stark contrast to the love, nurture, and affirmation I experienced with my mom. I lived in fear of making simple mistakes in front of him because of the scorn and the ridicule I would undoubtedly receive. I can still remember how angry he became one time when I spilled milk while trying to pour it into a bowl of cereal. He reacted as if I'd done it intentionally, as if there were no possible way a small child who was paying attention could ever miss the bowl. I learned to walk on eggshells around him to avoid arousing his temper and the piercing words that would fly out of his mouth when he was displeased. The fear of upsetting him only increased my anxiety, as well as the odds that I would make even more mistakes that angered him. As I grew older, spilling milk wasn't so much an issue anymore, but my father still found ways to call my life into question or to reiterate his vision of success for my life, regardless of how different it was from my own. The older I got and the more accomplished I became, the more our relationship seemed to improve. As my success became more evident and undeniable, his critiques seemed to lessen. He still found occasions to throw darts of inadequacy my way, but I learned to disregard them. I had adopted this principle from the Ten Commandments, honor your father and your mother. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 16. I was counting on the corresponding promise that doing so meant things would go well with me. That verse helped me and called me to take the high road in our relationship, regardless of whether I thought my father's actions deserved honor. I believed that I should honor him, not because of how he treated me, but simply because he was my father, imperfect and all. I was determined to think the highest thoughts concerning him, and also sought to understand him better. I told myself that considering the difficulties of his own upbringing, he was doing the best he could by me. In anticipation of this particular Father's Day, I decided to do something special for my dad. I knew he liked deep-sea fishing, so I decided to coordinate a trip to celebrate him on Father's Day. This was a big step for me. I loved my father, but we hadn't gotten past the awkwardness of spending any real length of time together. On this trip, we'd be on a boat together for several hours, miles away from shore. This should give you a good idea of how much I was really putting myself out there. Nevertheless, in the name of honor, I picked up the phone and extended the invitation. My dad seemed a little surprised by my offer, but he accepted the invitation and told me to keep him posted with the details. His positive response was a huge relief to me, and I felt a sense of accomplishment. Just presenting an idea to him that was acceptable without critique was a victory. Having it be something that honored him and would ultimately please him gave me a sense that things were beginning to turn around in our relationship. It felt as if this part of my life was finally making the kind of positive turn I'd experienced in so many other areas. Unfortunately, I was wrong. Things didn't exactly work out as I had planned. 2 weeks later, I phoned my father to give him the details of our trip. I was excited to have worked out the logistics, the trip was set, and all we needed to do was show up. However, I didn't get the enthusiastic response I had expected. The response I got was jarringly familiar. "I've made other plans for Father's Day," Dad said. "It's your fault this isn't going to work out, because you didn't give me the details sooner." I was speechless, and yet I told myself I shouldn't have been surprised. After all, it wasn't unlike my father to be erratic and critical. He didn't have much of a filter for what he said, nor did he show his sensitive side very often. I told myself I should be perfectly okay with Dad just being Dad in this scenario, as he has been in so many other times. I even told myself that I was okay. But I wasn't okay. And the accumulated brokenness from our relationship was about to come crashing down on me. It's okay not to be okay. As Father's Day approached, my mother asked me how plans for the fishing trip were shaping up. I told her that Dad had backed out, but that it was okay, because I really didn't want to go in the first place. Later, when a close friend asked me about the trip, I was beginning to give a similar answer when I felt overcome by a deep emotion I had trouble identifying. The feeling was both unfamiliar and familiar. Something that had been buried within me was rising to the surface, and it was no longer going to be quiet. To be honest, it felt like there was a screaming monster inside me that had suddenly been roused. This intruder beneath the surface was now setting off alarm bells that reverberated throughout every part of me. I tried to pray the intruder away, and even tried to distract myself from it, but it wouldn't leave. This unstoppable force was disrupting my life, and I could not shake it. With Father's Day just around the corner, I finally admitted that what was going on inside me would not simply go away. My peace was gone. My thoughts were fragmented. And to make matters worse, it was now Sunday morning, and in less than 2 hours, I would stand before my congregation for the first of our 2 Sunday morning services with an enormous problem. I had nothing to say. Whatever this monster within me was, it cut off the flow of love and clarity I relied on week in and week out to prepare and deliver my messages to the congregation. I felt overwhelmed with anxiety, but I was trying very hard to keep it all together. I was terrified to confront what was inside me. It was rage and pain and grief, and I didn't want to deal with any of it. If I took a real look at it,